Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Gentlemen, we all right?
Good evening. Yes,
very well. You?
Brightly?
No, not really. Still gutted from Friday, me.
Yeah, Friday was a nightmare, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, obviously, apologise to everybody who got tickets. Quite a few of the events at the venue have been cancelled over the weekend with the cases rising, and quite a lot of people got in touch saying, you know, that they won't be coming, so we thought it'd be best to put it back to March.
Yes.
We'll have a Christmas party in March, yeah?
We can make it an Easter party, can't we?
Yeah, and we can understand people not wanting to come. We don't want anybody spreading it and then missing Christmas, everybody didn't see the mums and dads and grands last year, did they?
Exactly, not to watch us three numpties on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
So it was with a very, very heavy heart, but a sensible head, I think.
Yes.
Is the terminology.
We go again on in March.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Hold them tickets when we're going again in March. Still be a good do.
Oh, it'll be a good. We'll have a good kick at ball, Chris. Don't worry about that.
We're not.
We'll still have a good kick at ball. I might even throw some Easter eggs out into the crowd.
It weren't just us that were pulling the plug that weekend either. We only ended up with three games. Who knows wins?
I know, yeah. It's... Surely everybody won.
I still got balls all. There are only three games.
You still didn't get 3 out of 3, right?
Nothing. I think I got two. But we'll have the league going again next week.
It spoilt it really, didn't it? With only three games. You know what I mean? It were.
Hopefully it'll be another full fixture next weekend. But the league will be live again. If you've not played before, 10 games to predict. Put your fiver in the pot. Make your predictions, and the best predictors split the pot a bit. I mean, I know you like a good spread, Chris, but bloody hell, I think £6.74 was. I hadn't even counted them. There were about 500 winners. I don't know.
At least one part is you've made getting on for 30% of your money, haven't you?
Yeah. So get a couple of Freddos on us.
Can you even get Freddos for that much now? I think they're even dearer, aren't they?
Are they?
They're not 10p like they used to be, old Freddos.
A couple of white mice, then.
Yeah, a couple of white mice will do you.
The return of Mick Rathbone.
See, the thing is about this one as well, it makes it even better. We've filmed this, haven't we?
Yeah.
So you can watch Mick's mannerisms. I tell you what gets me is how quickly he talks, but also it's as though he's really thinking about what he's saying, but really quickly.
Computes everything, and I know what you mean.
Do you know what I mean? It's like
it's a good skill, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beyond me. It's beyond my ability.
Obviously, the first book, Smell of Football, had come out just after we'd done the first one, and now he's got the second one out.
Yeah.
I think in that time, he just left Everton, hasn't he? He just left David Moyes at Everton beforehand, and then since then he's worked under Sir Alex at Man United after that, didn't he? England under 17s, 19s, won Euros with him, didn't he?
Yeah. Went to that foreign team and all, we were that.
That, and I think we see it in the episode, but he goes to Montserrat, doesn't he? And that needs a movie. He talks about it. I don't want to spoil anything, but like the Buddhist coach and just getting a team in the Caribbean who've not won. They haven't won in years, and then they got some victories.
They've won ever. I thought they'd not won ever. Had they?
I think they might have done earlier on against one of other little islands.
But to be fair to it, they're like they done well to actually get a team.
Yeah. I know.
Basically, if you're from Montserrat and you had a pair of Copas, you got picked. That's where it worked.
Yeah,
start,
unbelievable story.
And he's been loads of clubs, and he's since. I mean, you had him at Preston, didn't you? As a physio.
He came to Preston for a bit, yeah, to help Jack with the physio out, and he was brilliant.
And he's
so
still
enthusiastic.
He's still grafting there at Salford.
Yeah, I think he's been Wigan, Blackpool, like during short periods, hasn't he? Forest, yeah. But what a story!
What a guy!
Guy, yeah.
Yeah. You could listen to him all day, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
you could just let him speak at you all day.
Yeah, I think if you had like a 24-hour flight, I'd want Mick next to me. I think. You know what I mean?
Skip the movies.
Yeah, I don't think you need a movie. I think you just need to just light the touch paper, and then see you in Sydney, and what you need there.
I don't think he'd shut off for 22 and a half of them, like, but I might give it. Yeah,
he'd make that flight go quicker. That's for sure.
Yeah. Hey, well, we hope everybody's going to have a good Christmas as well. Obviously, this is the last episode before Christmas. I think we've got another special coming just after Christmas, between Christmas and New Year, before we finish for the end of the series. So, yeah, everybody have a good Christmas. No, we really appreciate it, don't we?
Yeah, everybody who's done the quizzes, listen to the podcast, Patreons, been to the live shows. Hopefully, we've made it a little bit better year than what it would have been for everybody. I imagine loads of better shitter, understandably. But if we just sprinkle a little bit of joy, we're more than happy with that, chaps, aren't we?
Should we get Mick in?
Aye, let's get Mick in. Merry Christmas, fuckers.
Mr. Baz Rathbone, how are we doing?
Oh, really good. Thanks for inviting me back.
Thanks for joining us once again.
I told the Salford lads I was coming on, and they'd all heard of the show.
Oh, excellent news.
Yeah. Perfect. Great start.
And were very complimentary of it too.
We weren't filming them the last time. We should have told you.
You could have brought us a change of clothes.
Well, yeah, well,
that's
actually
what I was getting at.
Funnily enough, I had a grey beard. I'm not even joking. I shaved it off this morning because my wife said, no, I'll do the beard. You don't need one. So I shaved it off, you know. So there you go.
Well, the new book's out.
Yeah, it's really exciting. When people say it's not about the money, it means it is about the money, don't they? Like, so,
is it not about the money, though?
No, so how can I phrase that? But I wanted that altruisticness. I wanted people to say it was good. And I spent a lot of time writing it and getting it printed and trying to get the quality really high so people wouldn't say, that's a CRAP version of the first book. I didn't want that, like, you know, and I'm really pleased and proud. And somebody asked me the other day, which one do you prefer? And I said, actually, the second one, because people are saying, to my face, that it's as good, stroke better than the first book. And I really, really wanted that. It meant the world to me, you know, that I hadn't kind of jumped on the bandwagon and then bought a second one out that weren't very good, actually.
Was it a different process this time?
No, because I wrote it all myself and that. The only process was I'm selling it on my website, like, you know, so it's not in all the shops now, so
yeah.
You haven't got all that.
Doing all the hard work yourself?
My wife is doing all the hard work. She, you know,
it is about the money.
Yeah, absolutely. She wants that new outfit for Christmas. She better lick those envelopes. But it's only for sale on the website and that, and it's really good and it's really exciting. So when I get home now and I switch on my giant iPad, the sales come flooding through and, you know, the pound signs are spinning around.
I thought it was about the money, but
it's not about the money. It's not about the money.
New challenge.
It's not I've about
just got
money.
I've just got a bollock and forgiven you it to read, haven't I?
Well, I said to you, it's nice, but it's not a library book, is it, Chris? You know what I mean? If you want a library book, go to the library, you know.
By the way, can you pass that on to me?
Yeah. And at the risk of repeating myself, it's not about the money, but buy your own bloody copy. But the point is, guys, I really wanted people to say it was as good as the first book, and people are saying that, and that means the world, and it's not about the money.
The first book's obviously about your career and the anxieties and everything that came with it, and I first met you, was it 10 years ago?
Gosh, I just left Everton, hadn't I?
And you said, even back then, that you felt like you were done, the full-time stuff was probably getting too much, the pressure and all that. How was it leaving Everton? I don't think we've ever spoke about
it. It was the most incredible day of my life, that final day. And I was just there. We beat Portsmouth. That's how long ago it was. Beat Portsmouth. A couple of days later, in the training ground, and Davey just said to me, "Baz, have you got a minute?" And I went into his office, and he said, "Baz," he said, "it's time for a change." And I said, "Oh, don't go, Dave. You're doing a good job." And he went, "No." He went, "A change in the medical team." I said, "You've never liked Matt." He went, "Baz, it's not Matt." I said, "Danny." He went, "It's not Danny." I said, "Right, whoa. I said, "Right, in the medical team, not Matt, not Danny." I said, "No." I said, "You'll have to give me a clue." He goes, "Baz, he's in the room now and it's not me." I'm looking under the table, behind the curtains, and then the penny dropped. You're out. That's it. And you tumble down the stairs in a state of shock.
You were contemplating leaving anyway, so was it a relief?
Yes, because, I mean, that actually didn't really happen like that. I've kind of taken that, I think it's called poetic license. I've taken that over the last 10 years and made that story my own. I'm David's biggest fan. He's a fantastic manager. I do say in the book, please give the guy a chance. He'll show you how good he is. I think I've been proved right. Sometimes it's just time for the change. I've been there 15 years, 7 days a week. I decided it was time. But you know what? And I say, I don't know if I ever would have knocked on that door. I went to knock on the door and Dave was sat there. Then I pulled away and went back to my office. I thought, what are you doing? Who gives up a job like this, six-figure wages? Who does that? You've got young kids. What are they going to say to Dad when they're going away in a bloody caravan instead of a five-star hotel? You know, it's time for universities, driving lessons. So I got back in my office. I was spooked like then. I thought, no, I'm burned out. It's time to go down the corridor again. Went to knock on the door. Couldn't do it when I sat down. I thought, what are you doing? What are you doing? Then Dave knocked on my door, got me in and said, look, you know, I think we've come to the end of it. Like,
so does that mean that you got a settlement to leave?
Yeah, I mean, it's not about the money. You know, it's not about the money. It wasn't about that. It was professional pride. But it was really funny because the different things that go through your head. I mean, we stayed really, really good friends. And we meet up for coffee and stuff, and he would pay. And I'd say, well, you know, you'll have to. I've got no money. I got sacked. Oh, you were there. You know, so, you know, but I use the word pejoratively, sack. You know, it makes a nice story. And I guess I was sacked. Could I have stayed on? No. So I guess I was. But it was more than that. It was, you know, 15 amazing years with an amazing guy who gave me everything. And it was just time to move on and that life.
So do you know when you've had coffee since? Have you ever actually said to him, Why, Dave?
No, because I wasn't performing very well. I'd done I'd done 7 days a week for 18 years. The last year we had a tsunami of injuries. And whether you like it or not, it affects you. Because I go in every morning and I say to the coaches, no, worse than we thought, no chance, 3 months, 6 months, he's not going to be available. And they're not blaming me. And I can assure you, I've never injured a player as a physio, like, you know. Actually, I did last year when I was at Everton. I was crossing some balls for the keepers and I whipped one in. It had, like, you know, dip and swerve. The young goalie come out. It was too much for him. And he come out like, and you know, the menu stick in the ground. He fell into that and sprained his ankle really bad. But I carried him off. I caused the injury. But
carry him off and rehab him.
Yeah. So I have actually injured a player. But in terms of that going up every morning with all that bad news, it does affect you personally. And those guys were my friends, David, and it was Roundy there, and Jimmy and Taffy and Chris Woods and that. They are and were my friends. And they weren't really blaming me, obviously, but you do see that disappointment. And, you know, they're not expecting me to work miracles, but you're the only one they can kind of look at. And I'm telling you, I spoke to lots of physios, and after a while, that grinds you down. And I think I just come to the stage where, you know, I say every day of the week, more or less for 18 years, you just need a break. That's all.
Because there was a lot of stuff, I think, when you just left about false rumours. You know, was it the Phil Neville? It was the mismanagement of his injury.
Yeah, that's what it said, but that wasn't actually true. You know, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. He had a complicated injury. It wasn't easy to manage. It was managed correctly and that, like, you know. He wrote the foreword of the first book, so he couldn't have had any hard feelings, like, you know. But it was just a parting of the ways and that. And I do say that after the 100th word, sack. I do start to soften it and call it a parting of the ways, like, you know. So me and Dave remained good friends the day after. and to this day, and we're really good friends, and I'm his biggest fan. I think he's a great fella. I think he's a magical manager. And now he's been given time, he's showing how good he really
flying,
is.
Like, isn't
you
know,
absolutely.
Do you think if he'd have been given time at Man U?
100% do. Yeah. He builds teams and he's careful and he looks after the club's money and he builds teams slowly but surely. And he would have been absolutely ideal for the job.
I'm surprised he hasn't made back on the phone. Get you down there?
No, that ship sailed. It was funny because I was at Man United when Dave was there as well, and I was with the 21s as a kind of mentor to that squad, not a physio. And it was really strange for me to look across to the first team and see Dave talking with other physios about stuff. And it was really weird because did I want to be there or not? Yes and no. And I even couldn't really understand it and explain it. It was just odd, I guess, like, you know.
When you left Everton then, did you make a conscious decision to step away from all that and look at something different, like the you know, you went into the psychology of young players?
Yeah, I did, but, you know, somebody said a great thing about football the other day. When you're in it, you want out, and when you're out of it, you want in. And the more I've thought about it, sitting here now, I've just been out with Salford today playing and joining in training and stuff and working with the lads and that, and thinking, God, how much longer? But as I say, every time I've came out, I've wanted in. But when you're in, you kind of want out. Like, you know, it is that sort of a contradiction in terms. I guess it mirrors the nature of the game. The highs are high and the lows are low. And it's that kind of job anyway. You've all played and stuff like, you know, and you know yourself, you get man of the match, Chris scored a great goal. You're up there, get dragged after 60 minutes, like, you know, and you feel terrible, like, you know. So it kind of mirrors the way that football is for us all, I suppose.
Did you miss the pressure then? You know, when you went into a job that you didn't really... I think, I know you said, you could have been there or...
Yeah, but, you know, it's this is the weirdest thing, right? So I came out of football and the pressure's gone. So by the time I tumbled down the stairs, literally, and got in my car and my head was spinning, that, you know what? On the way home, I'm starting to feel pretty damn good. Because when I say on the thing, I went in the next day to clear my desk and one of the players came up and he'd had surgery. And he went, Baz, he went, I think my wounds are infected. And as he rolled his trouser leg up, if he'd run the day before, I'm telling you, my shirt would have been stuck to my back and the sweat would have been pouring before he got to the wound, like, you know. But it didn't matter anymore. And as he rolled, I was like, well, it's not my problem anymore now. It wasn't infected. And, of course, we'd have sorted him out. Like, but that was a great example of that pressure's gone. But you know the kind of frightening thing about it? And it, I guess it's like a drug, isn't it? After a while, you start missing that pressure. So I started doing like, what's the worst thing you could ever do? Sportsman's dinners. I'll do some sportsman's dinners because that's got to be the hardest. So the trouble with sportsman's dinners, it's a trap that surrounds you from behind. So somebody approaches you and says, oh, will you do a sportsman's dinner next 9 months from now? And you say, yeah, because that date next July is never coming. And that money represents nothing more than some easy money for a date that's never coming. But that's the trap, you see, because you say yes and then they print the tickets, you're now trapped. You're closed in. And I'll tell you what, you might think 9 months go slowly. Maybe if you were pregnant, you probably would. But that 9, 8, 7, 6 on, before you know it, it's a week building up and now you're in trouble. You're doing that and people are there. And I got there like that night. It was the doing Preston, like, and I'm telling you now, I was 10 times worse than any time I've ever played in my life. And the problem is, you get there at 6 and then you experience 4 hours of sheer hell before you go on. And I mean, you can't eat. You rearrange the food skillfully so you don't look too nervous and that. And you're waiting. There's a strange phenomenon, though, because like the guy who's getting hanged, after a while, you just want it over and done with. You know what I mean? So I've been wanting the clock to stop for 9 months, especially the last 3 or 4 days. But now I think, do it, 8 o'clock, please be 10 o'clock. And I'm waiting for it. And then even to this day, if somebody taps a glass with a spoon, my legs go to jelly. You're waiting for that. You've all been there, dicky bow people, getting drunk, having a great time. You better be good, Baz. We'll boo if you're not. You think, oh, Jesus Christ. How am I here? And then all of a sudden, 10 o'clock, the witching hour, tap, tap, tap. Right, good evening, gentlemen. The guy gets, good evening, gentlemen. We're going to start with the main attraction now. One of the finest after-dinner speaks in the country. I thought, right, I've done none. Why are you saying I'm one of the finest afternoon speakers in the country when I've done none? That's additional pressure. I don't need the pressure. So then he goes, tink, tink, tink. OK, we're going to get Baz up now, like, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like, but first, get yourself a drink from the bar. I was halfway up. Oh, sit back down again. Oh, Jesus Christ, right, you know. So 10 minutes later, you're churning now. You're very close to, I guess, passing out with pressure. 10 minutes later, ting, 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 ting. Everybody stops, looks, turns towards you, like, expectantly. The bloke goes, right, big moment now. So Baz is going to come on now. So if you want a final cigarette... Chris, I was up again. I'm off, are you? I'm back down again, like, you know. So I think, oh, God, I never did you any harm. Why are you killing me? Like, you know, 10 minutes, 600 seconds later, like, you know, tap, 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 tap on the spoon. Right, finally, we're going to get the after-dinner speaker on now. So we'll do the raffle first. They're ringing me out. They're absolutely ringing me out, like, you know. And then finally I got up and it went amazingly well. It was fantastic. It was the happiest moment of my life. And I got a standing ovation at the end and that. And it was really interesting about comedy, really interesting, because there was a guy called, what's that comedian name who was very big in this? The Irish guy who had...
Cricket?
Yes, he had left on his right, well, he right on his left, he had a bowler hat on. He'd come here, and there's more, and there's more. He came on after me. And whether it was relief in me, and I was just laughing hysterically, everyone was laughing at his joke. So he comes on, he goes, come here, there's more. He goes, my dad back home, he changed every pane of glass in our house before he realised he had a crack in his glasses. So people are crying at that. My ma, she knitted me three socks because I wrote and said I'd grown an extra foot. People are crying, he goes... My new sat nav's amazing. I drove past the zoo, it said bear left. People are crying at these jokes and that. But the important point afterwards, he comes to me, because it went really well, that you did well, and it went really well. Like, you know, I said, oh, you were amazing. He goes, yeah, but he said there's a golden hour. He said, and the golden hour is it's to do with drink. And you know yourself, when you're about for a drink, first couple of pints are slow. But between pint four and eight, you're having the best time of your life. 8 to 12, you're half dead, aren't you, with your shots? So this golden hour, we went on the golden hour. And he said to me, I've done that act either too early or too late and no one's laughed. So it was really interesting insight into comedy, like, you know. So I started doing that. And you know what? When I thought about it afterwards, I thought, right, why are you doing this? Because if you want that unflappable, no notes, speaking from memory, calm, relaxed anecdotes, never mess up. Because when you do a sportsman's dinner, there's two overwhelming fears. Fear number one is your stuff's rubbish. But a slightly bigger fear is that you'll dry, I think it's called, and freeze on the night. And people have paid 50 quid to hear you. It's not your best man's speech at your brother's wedding. This is professional speaking. And if you make a mess of it, they're going to let you know. And they're going to let your friends know as well. That everybody on Twitter, by the way, this guy's hopeless. 50 quid, it was a joke and that, like, you know. So, but as I say, when I assessed it afterwards, I thought, why have you done that? You've had all that pressure. You've come out of it. And you've gone back into that. And, you know, I kind of concluded it was that addiction to that pressure. You've had it for so long, every Friday night, lying awake at night and driving into the ground on a Saturday night with your hands sweaty on the steering wheel. Now you've got to replace it with a kind of more extreme version. So that's where we were.
Have you got a newfound respect for me now, lads?
I could never do the afternoon.
It's really difficult.
I've got one tomorrow, one Friday.
Well, good luck to you.
And if anyone wants to book me, by the way, please do get in touch.
The only thing I'll say is I did four, and by the fourth, I was eating the odd piece of carrot. You know, I was getting a bit of carrot over.
Start eating again.
Yeah, so I went from 100% fear to about 97% on the fourth one. And the sad thing was, I packed it and then I went back into club football, like, you know. And in a way, I'd done the hard bit. I'd done the hours and hours of rehearsing it, so it looks unrehearsed, you know. So I should have really carried on. But it went really well. In fact, I was approached by an agent and he said he'd get me work on cable TV. digging out the trenches.
So, I mean, obviously, in that period, that sabbatical, should we call it, away from football,
post sacking,
you've done a bit of after dinner. I mean, how what was the period that you were out?
I probably had 6 months off when I wrote the book. That was a great experience, I must say, putting together. I can't explain how marvellous the experience is that you would write a book and somebody would want to publish it, and that one day your book will be in Waterstones. It's the most amazing experience you can have. I don't know if it's about validation, you know, is it ego? I don't know.
As well as your self-doubt as well that you've had probably all your life.
I guess. And then he got to the final three for the British Football Book of the Year, and I was at the Savoy with my Dickie Bow on, and I was rehearsing my speech, and I was going to say, it's ironic that all the self-doubt, and it's only by writing about the self-doubt, ironically, I've come to the point where I can be accepted and win something. And I had my way, I thought, I'll go back round that table, through there. That's quite tight. Squeeze through there. Excuse me. Sorry. Proud but modest. Anyway, I never won. Story of my life. But as I say, it's a marvellous experience, you know. So I'm so thankful for enjoying that experience.
During this time, though, are you wanting to get back into football? And are you waiting for the phone to go? Are you actively putting your name out there?
Well, it's interesting because you think, when I left Everton, you think by the time you get home, there's 50 phone calls. But there's no phone calls because there's only jobs when there's vacancies. So whilst a club might like you to be there, if they've got their medical staff, you can't go there. But by the same degree, things change so quickly. And that phenomenon of that life-changing phone call. So I've retired for the last 5 years and give a leaving speech. So 5 years ago, England won the Euros in Malta. I gave a really nice speech to all the players and that. I got champagne, shirt, card. Then the year after, I stayed another year because I thought, well, if you keep leaving, you get stuff and that, So I've done another year, left again. Shirt and card. I thought, I'll let you off with the champagne, but I didn't get the champagne the second time. Stayed another year for stuff. Third time, was coming back from England games in Northern Brittany, left, gave the speech, which I'm very good at by now. Just got a Moonpig card. So the speech is getting better, the Preds are going out. Anyway, then I went to Forest, and I could only stay a year there. And I left at the end, and they got me some prints. So I was doing the speech, but I saw they bought me a really expensive Paul Smith leather bag. So I kind of hurried the speech because you want to Google the value of the bag, don't you?
Not about the money.
Anyway, thanks very much. You've been great. Google Paul Smith bag. Jesus Christ, £899, buzzing. You know, and a watch, by the way. And then I moved to Everton then and left and got a £600 Hugo Boss voucher and a watch as well. You know, so I'm kind of moving on now, and getting loads of different stuff. But in terms,
like a magpie.
It's like a magpie, yeah. But in terms of that life-changing stuff, so I left all them clubs and I looked at my wife and I said, it's our time now. So I left Wigan. I left Wigan and we was on the beach with my wife and I'm looking at it and I think, you know what, I've been away so many times and I'm 59 years of age. I've had a good innings now. And it's time for us to do those things, to go on those holidays, to walk the dog and just to be together and grow old gracefully together, so I'm sat on the beach in Marbella thinking, it's mine and Julie's time now. Phone's ringing. Dave Weir. Baz, it's Dave Weir. Will you come to Nottingham Forest as head physio? On my way. She can wait.
On a serious note, though, did she have to take some adjustment to you being in the house all the time?
Not really, because I was kind of doing other things. I went into Preston for a little bit as well soon after that, and I started doing the England work, which actually meant I was away a lot because it's all overseas camps orientated. So not so, but we're best friends. We've got on fantastically well anyway, But she knows that I do need stroke, like to work and that, In fact, she was trying to get me a job in Brisbane the other day, which I thought was amazing. Isn't that supportive?
Brisbane, Australia?
Yeah. I'm just thinking,
is there a place near Blackburn called Brisbane? No.
Isn't that supportive? So there you go. But no, she understands it, and I do love to work and you need to work. And do you know what? At the end of the day, I'm at Salford now. I keep calling it Bradford. I'm at Salford now. I love it. And people say, what are you saying? What, you're only for 2 weeks at first. But you know when people you really like ask you to stay and when the players ask you to stay, that is a very, very powerful thing and it's very hard to turn down. So I said I would stay. You know, it's as simple as that. And, you know, we all want to be wanted. And I say it's very hard to turn that down.
Mm.
So
you mentioned the Preston when you came back and helped Jacko, who was head physio at the time. Yeah. You used to take all the... It was the warm-ups and the, with the rehab, a lot of the rehab. Yeah. And you were fitter than every single one of us. Well, did that continue at Man U, England?
Yeah. I've been outside the times a couple of times at Salford, you know, to be perfectly honest. But you know what I started doing? When I got to 50, I decided I would run round the training pitch in 50 seconds. And then every year... So a couple of days ago, actually, on my 63rd birthday, I ran round the training pitch at Salford in 61 seconds, actually. A bit smaller than Finch Farms' full-size Goodison pitch. I'd done it last year and the year before. So I've always managed to... What will happen when I don't do it? I don't know. In a funny kind of way, that extra second is getting easier every year. So I do like to keep...
strong.
I do like to keep myself fit. And I say in the book, there's probably a darker side to that. Can't you do the job from the side? Can't you do the job while jogging by the players? Yes, you can. But the kind of sad answer to that is, while I can run at the front and do the sprints and feeding the ball and the one-twos and the shuttles with the players, the fact that I can't turn on a laptop doesn't really matter. The fact I don't know what a paradigm is or pre-activation is, I thought that was in you. You didn't last long at 6, to be perfectly honest. Right, you know? But I don't know what that stuff means. I don't know the new stuff. But at the moment, it doesn't matter because I'm at the front running with the players out in the rain, knocking the balls, doing the one-twos, doing the shuttles. So in a kind of funny way, it kind of shields you from the modernity of stuff. And that's sort of the thread of the second book, isn't it? Gradually growing older. And, you know, like... When I started getting to Birmingham's team when I was 17, it always said, and the 19-year-old fullback. He said, drive me mad. He said, well, what's the big deal? Well, to get in the team at 19 is good in the top division, but at 17, it's bloody fantastic. Yeah. And all my life, I had that, and that kind of spurned the second book. I remember once I was playing for Blackburn in an FA Cup game, fifth round at Goodison, of all places. And apparently it said on the radio, Trevor Stephen and Gary Stevens working the ball down the right, taking advantage of the ageing legs of the veteran Rathbone, 24. I was 20, 24, I was, you know. So I've always had people thinking you're older. And that, so I had an operation on my knee and I was like 52 and it was a big operation. And I thought, right, I'm going to have to join a gym. So I joined the gym in Witton Park in Blackburn. And I went in and there were a couple of nurses there. There must have been some health kit going on, Blackburn and Darwin Council. And I went in, morning, ladies. And they went, oh, excuse me, sir, are you heart attack or angina? Heart attack? I said, I'm 10K in 36 minutes, actually. And then on the way out, 3 months later, I got friendly with some lovely old guys who might have been younger than me. On the way out, it works, Baz, if you've got a minute, I've been watching you on the run, treadmill and that, like, you know, would you like to join our walking football team? Oh, Jesus Christ, like, you know. And I always had this thing about people looking older. And then I tell that story about when I was at Man United, I looked after the lads on loan and we had a connection with the team in Antwerp, Royal Antwerp. I thought I'd go over and watch our two lads play on a Friday night. I went over, Man United suit and all that, like, you know. I get to the game, they won 5-0. And Belgian people like a beer, don't they? So I go in the lounge after and people are pissed, basically. That's great, they won 5-0, they're pissed. I go in like, and you know when you're a little bit famous, not really, but a little bit, you are aware of a kind of nudge going on, like, you know, and I thought, oh, it's happening here, like, you know, as my book made it. I'll never forget it. I had my reading glasses on as well, and I'm in there, like, you know, I've got my Man United suit, reading glasses on, and eventually, after the nudging, a fan comes over, unscrunches a team sheet, and he goes, will you sign, please? And I said, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, best wishes, man. And I thought, in, like, you know, and he goes, thank you, Sir Bobby. No. No.
Well, see, it's different as well.
Yeah, well, I was 54, you know, a lovely fella, great player, great human being.
But he's 80.
He was 74 at the time. I googled it, like, you know, 74, like, you know.
Did you correct him that you weren't?
No.
No, you take it, don't you?
I thought, I'll take the glory and probably have a hair transplant. So,
did you get out on the pitch at United? Did you test yourself against the first team?
Well, when you go into a new club, you want to make a good effect, don't you? And I went into this kind of poorly... I didn't enjoy it, Man United. I say it in the book. It's a great club. People were great to me. But it was kind of... You know, when I was at Everton, you're the head of the medical. You were on the pitch. You're defined. That's your role. It's invaluable. The meeting can't start without Baz. He runs on the pitch. We get that. And now we're going to these kind of less well-defined roles. And I had one of these roles at Manchester United. And the club's great. The people were amazing to me in that. But I weren't really feeling that, like, you know... So I went in on my first day, and Warren Joyce was there, who's a good mate of mine. He goes, come on, Baz, out on the pitch, get changed. And that, like, you know, so I go onto the training pitch with the 21s, it was, and there's some great players like Michael Keane and Sam Johnson and Jan Hussein and Jesse Lingard, some really, really top players who were like 20 in them days. And we start with a box, and I'm on the outside of the box, like, you know, and I'm thinking, my heart's pounding, like, you know, in case I give the ball away, this frail old guy, like, you know. Anyway, the ball goes to Jesse Lingard. He shovels a bad pass to me, like, you know. Yeah. And they close in on me, the two in the middle. Anyway, back through Makeda's legs and across the box, like, you know. And we had to stop. Everyone was laughing so much. We had to stop, like, you know. Anyway, then we go over to the next pitch to finish off with some hard running. And we do, like, the width pitch, the width run, and there's Nicky Button and Joyce, and this is a race between two players, right? I want to see a winner, like, you know. I think, well, this would be interesting to see the levels of these lads compared to Everton's senior players. So I'm standing there like the pair off, like, you know, and the run is from the sideline, first 18 and back, first six and back, far six and back, far 18, far line and back, gut buster, eyeballs out, I want winners, Butty's saying, I want winners. I'm thinking, interesting. Be interested. Anyway, next news, Shinny Kagawa comes across, like, you know, Warren, can I've been out for 3 weeks, can I do extra? He went, yeah, you have to run against Baz. Everyone was laughing their heads off, like, you know what I mean? You know. So anyway, we're last to go, we're the last race, the last feature of the day. And they do all the runs and the eyeballs out, like, you know. Anyway, we kind of bow, like, you know, because obviously Japanese, bow. And then off we go. I felt great, you know, like when you're running in a vacuum. And it seemed I waited all my life for this day. Anyway, we're there and back, second one and back, third and back. I feel like, you know when you can lift a car off your child? It felt like that, you know what I mean? Lift the car off the kid, pull the kid out, like, you know. I felt fantastic, and I had him, and I knew it, and I knew I had him. I could hear him breathing heavy now, but I'm running through this kind of vacuum state, and now the lads are shouting for Baz, and one's laughing, go on, Baz. We hit the final line, fine. All I've got to do now is get back to glory. And I changed gear, and I was like 15. I used to be a really good runner when I was at school, like, you know, one of the Birmingham schools, 800 metres and that, like, you know. And it was those days again. And I just left him and run home. And
left him for dead?
Yeah, for dead, yeah. And to be fair, everyone laughed, and he was laughing as well, like, you know. And
he must have thought, fucking hell, I'm another 3 weeks off.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah. I bet the England stuff was good. I know it was part-time, wasn't it? Was it?
It was amazing. And
was it under-17s?
It was under-17s the first few years. And then we did the 19s. We won the Euros twice. And I talk about a lot that experience in Malta and to win the Euros for your country. And I say, was it better than Champions League at Everton? Was it better than the pros at Preston? Was it better than getting to the FA Cup final, beating Man U on pens at Wembley? It was, because it's your country, it's the lions on your chest and that, like, you know. And when you're on the out, I used to do all the fitness for duty forms for your Rodwells and your James Vaughan. And yeah, there you go, done, email it off and that, without even giving a minute's thought about where they were going, what it meant to them, what they were up to and that with the 17s or 19s or 20s, whatever it was. And then when I got in it, you realise how absolutely amazing it is to work for your country. And I'll tell you, wherever you go over Europe, those... That shirt is the most powerful, most sought-after shirt in the world. And everywhere you go, it makes you so proud to be English and then a part of that, like, you know.
Not mentioning any names, but, you know, obviously at that age, a few young lads earning big money. Any come with a chip on the shoulder?
No, they were fantastic. And, you know, it's really interesting, though, because my first year was the 94s. So we had Raheem Sterling and we had Jordan Pickford and we had Ward-Prowse and we had Nathan Redmond. And now I'm starting to struggle. Nick Powell, Tyler Blackett. Now I'm running out of players. So those 40 players we used that year who were the best, and we got to the semis in Novi Sad in Serbia. Holland beat us and went on to win it. We should have won that game probably. But you've named them players now, and now you're struggling. And a lot of those players, I Googled them recently, and there's nothing wrong with playing National League North or South at all. It's a great standard. But a lot of those players who were deemed to be the best of their generation at 16, 17, they've now dropped down to that level, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of it. That's how competitive football is.
Because in our youth team, we speak about a lot about getting, and we're speaking about it off air, about managers in your face. You know, if they're having a shit half, they come in at half time and give people bollockings.
Yeah.
Because I know England have been successful the last few years. How was it with the staff there? Was it John Peacock was manager?
Absolutely amazing. Your favourite uncle. Everything's done to. I mean, these men are children because they're 16, 17, you know. So it's a very sympathetic approach, as of course it should be. They were amazing with those kids, how they nurtured them. Never raised their voices, nothing like that. It was absolutely fantastic.
From a personal point of view as well, like at the time when you weren't too sure where you were going to go with your career, to go to all them countries, seeing all those sites. And, you know, countries
that you though.
It did at the time because I was doing that kind of one-on-one work and the book and that, like, you know, so it fitted in really nicely. And the thing about England, who gets to go to Sarajevo? Who gets to go to Tbilisi? Who gets to go to Yerevan? You know, you go into places like that and all of history and stuff like that.
I've got no idea where any of them three okay.
I'll be honest with you.
Well, go through Bolton, keep going through the Far East, Skegness, and then go across Europe, go across the Caspian Sea, and you'll find them all there. So you've got that, like, great experience of travelling as well.
Places that you wouldn't visit.
Who gets to go to Sarajevo and that, like, you know, and I love history and that, like, you know, to stand on the spot where essentially the First World War started and that, like, you know, see all the history, the bullet holes, all the graves and that. Then that juxtaposition of right next door is where Torvald Dean won the goal with Bolero in the ice rink next door. It's just amazing to think, God, how am I here? Like, you know.
I can't imagine the young lads were taking that in and appreciating it as much.
Well, we had a meeting one day and John Peacock says, right, everybody, well done. And it's gone really well. And we're off tomorrow and everybody's off and we're going to have a nice down day. So show of hands, we're going by where the most people want to go. So option one, there's the museum to the genocide in 1916, I think it was, I don't want to get this wrong. Allegedly, the Turks massacred a million Armenians. There's a new genocide museum. He said, we can either go there, that's pretty new, like, you know, we can go there. Or number two, about 20 minutes from here, there's the Abbey of, called the Gegrok Abbey, and it's a cave with an abbey built into the cave where apparently the spear that pierced Christ was for 500 years. Armenia is the oldest Christian country, and you can go to these caves and see where that spear was kept and that, like, you know. I thought, oh my God, who gets to absorb all that? Option three, we can go down to the Mall. Anyway, 20 minutes later, we're sat having an Armenian cake and a coffee and the lads.
And the lads are all in top shop.
Yeah, the lads are in Zara and Mitt Monsoon. We're sat there, like, you know. So, but as I say, it is really interesting, like, you know, and me and Simon Smith, we take the goalies out sometimes when nobody else was training. And in Sarajevo, we took it would have maybe Angus Gunn. I don't know who the goalies were. Angus Gunn and maybe Dean Henderson. Me and Smith take them out and do a load of extra goalkeeping and that. And the ball kept going over or by the side of the goals into the field. And I'd climb over. It's really nice. People are so friendly. There's a guy on the hill, like, you know, waving away. And I'm waving away. And every time I go over, he's waving away. And I'm waving away, hello, and that, you know. Eventually he comes running down, he goes, that field's not been cleared for mines.
You would have trotted in getting balls.
It goes back to that, doesn't it? They're fucking expensive, them balls, aren't they?
Yeah, when you're in England,
them balls are expensive.
If one of them balls bounces on that, that ball could be lost.
Oh, dear. So what was your role at Man United?
It was a kind of, when I went there, they said, find your own way, find where you think you can fit in. It was a kind of mentoring role based on the book and that kind of, and it was, I didn't feel the role. The people there were fantastic. The nicest. It's what a club. I wouldn't. How could you say anything bad? But I weren't feeling that role. And it was really interesting because a lot of new stuff had come into football, and me being a dinosaur, I was kind of rejecting it in those days. I wouldn't so much now, and I'd respect that role. But I didn't feel that role and that. And one day, I was giving the under-14s a talk on how to get the best night's sleep, for God's sake, like, you know. And we're saying, oh, you know, yeah, switch your devices off early.
Did you bring your book in?
No.
Go on. Have your last wank at 7 o'clock.
No, we wanted to wake up eventually. And I'm giving the talk and obviously close the curtains and switch. I'm thinking, for God's sake. And I'm giving the lads a talk and that, like, you know. And one of their coaches was a famous old Man U legend, bringing the class of 92 through. And I caught his eyes and I saw into his eyes, and he's looking back at me, and I know what he's thinking. He's thinking, what the effing hell's this come to? And you know what? I was thinking it myself. So I just didn't really feel the role. But when I look back now, it's a very valuable role. And I went on the training pitch every day and I joined in. At the start of the season, I'll sit the lads down and say, right, I'm Baz. I've had a career, I've made a lot of mistakes and suffered a lot with nerves and that, like, you know. If you want to come and chat and share stuff, come and see me. I'll never mention this again. I went out on the training pitch every day, and sometimes I maybe take the defender some heading. So I made myself busy out on the training pitch. I went and watched all the lads on loan all over Europe, all over the country. So I kind of found some viability in the role. But I just felt that, oh, it's a kind of non-role and that, like, you know. But when I look back now, it wasn't so much. And a couple of players who, I see Michael Keane at Everton, and we talk about them days. I watched him play for Leicester a lot. When he was on loan at Leicester, he said, yeah, it was really good that, like, to have somebody to talk to and stuff. And a couple of the lads who I work with in Man United, like, you know, and they said it was really good that knowing there was somebody there to talk to. So I probably undersold myself and the role. It was probably a bit avant-garde for the time. And I think now most clubs have got somebody doing that role, like, you know. I tell you this incredible story. The book's about fate as well and all these things happening. So I get a job at Man United. We have a player who goes on loan to Birmingham. So I go back to the killing fields of St Andrews. And this lad's, it's incredible. It's incredible. So I'm there 40 years on.
The killing fields.
Yeah. So I. And do you know what's worst about that? The worst about getting stick off your hometown is they're your people.
Yeah.
And you know what the fans are like? Well, we pay you money, we'll boo if we want. I said, yeah, but you're my parents. But that's the worst.
Just to add some context, if anybody who's not listened to the first one, obviously, playing at Birmingham.
I had a difficult time at Birmingham, my hometown club. All my fault, all my problem, all my perceptions of how massive and everyone looking at you. So I go back to Man United, and this player's playing left back that I played. It's unbelievable. And he's not playing well. It was against Blackburn. Gary Bowie, I think, took the team. We talked about it the other day. They were 4-0 down at half-time. The lad got taken off, like, you know. The incredibility, is that a word, of going back all them years later, mentoring a lad in that number three shirt who was getting a load of stick. It's unbelievable. At half-time, I went in, some really old guys came up and they went, Mickey Rathbone. And I said, wow. I said, good spot. Yeah, we were just saying what a good player you were. I said, right. I said, I'm the worst player Birmingham ever had in their career. The worst player. And they went, nah, we were saying she'd never have sold you and Trevor Francis, like, you know. So the bottom line is there. People don't even, A, they don't know who you are, and B, the ones who do can't remember anything anyway. So I played 450 games. So that's 450 sleepless nights, you know. For what? I can't even remember them. They can't remember them. They think I was a great player. So, and that's what we do, don't we? We bring it all on ourselves and that, and we think everyone's looking at you. And I used to say to the lads who were struggling with it all and that, I say, you know, maybe I'd meet a lad from, let's say, Bury, and, oh, God, I'm so under pressure, the pressure, pressure. I say, right, next time you sit in your car, put Bury's ground on. Bit of a poor choice, Betty, because unfortunately they're not in the league. So put Oldham's ground on, like, you know, turn it to the left and zoom out and see how quite kind of small that ground is in Oldham. Go out again and see how small Oldham is in Greater Manchester. Go out again, see how small, tiny, infinitesimally small that is in the north of England. Go again. England's a tiny, tiny country in Europe. Go again, see how small Europe is in the West. keep going, keep going. Look at the world now and realise that actually, who cares? Who knows who that, like, you know what I mean? And when I was at Everton the first time, and if we had a bad week, and sometimes things don't go well, the old dog would say to me, oh, well, Baz, he goes, at the end of the day, we're just ants crawling around the world. We're all going to die. Who cares? And do you know what?
This is the dog.
Yeah. who cares if he dies of that injection I've just given him? No. But, you know, but there was a great truth in what he said. Because at the end of the day, it is just a game. And people don't really want to hear you say that, oh, it's life and death and I can't eat my tea and that. But I can only, my lad plays for Rotherham now, and I text him before every game, run and smile. And if he takes you to, well, he's already been at Man U. If he takes you to Barcelona, great. If he takes you to the pub team, great. As long as you run and smile and do your best, who really cares? And you know what? If you play for the pub team, and a lot of the lads I saw who were struggling, the footballers and that, when we came down to it, the option of going out the game, and what if you go out the game? I met a player once. Oh, I'm not playing well. I'm really enjoying it. I feel under pressure. The money's on my back. My parents. Oh, it's a nightmare. The agent's on my back. Oh, it's a nightmare. I can't cope. Right, give them an escape. So you're telling me that if you don't play better in 3 months' time, you're out the game. And where will you go from there? He said a non-league team. And what'll happen there? Because, well, it's good there'll be 500 on there. And the owner gets you a job in his factory and that. I said, well, the thing that you're terrified about doesn't actually sound that bad. All the pressure's gone. You're still playing and earning £300 or £400 a week, would it be? Yeah. And you've got a nice, easy job as well. So the thing that you're terrified of is not that terrifying. And when you give them that kind of exit, all of a sudden, yeah, you know what? It's not that bad because actually I can get out. There is life beyond it. But when you're in it, you can't see anything other than the game. I didn't play well. Oh, my God, all the people are pointing at me, which they're not. We've ascertained that, haven't we? Like, you know. So I think it really helped in that way. And I think when I was a young player, I really would have benefited from that, like, you know.
I was just going to say, a lot of the fair few jobs that you went into, Wigan and Blackpool, it was going into a struggling club.
Yeah.
Not just a struggling team, a struggling club,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really difficult. And I've been really lucky because I was always with winning teams and that. And I went in there kind of late on for short periods of time only because of the England work. And you saw the other side of the coin. And I say in the book, you know, a losing team stinks and a winning team smells great. And you soon smell that. And it's like nobody's fault, really. It's often expectations, new managers, changing managers. I don't want him. I want them six. You don't train with us, in, out, and all that kind of stuff, like, you know. And I saw that at Wigan and I saw it at Blackpool and that. And the managers we're only human, aren't we? The managers, Warren Joyce was then, Graham Batter took over, and it was Clark, who was really good, and Tomo, you'll know Tomo as well. Good guys, doing their best. Couldn't get results, you know, and, you know, five at the back, four at the back, three at the back, run them, don't run them, days off, no days off, shout at them, don't shout at them, lads on load, young lads in, trying everything, but unfortunately not really being able to turn it round because the team weren't just quite good enough, and that's no disgrace. It's really interesting because the narrative has to be you're at the bottom, so you're shit and you don't care and you don't try. You don't try. But I was there and we did care and we weren't shit. And we just weren't quite as strong as other teams. But that always becomes a narrative, doesn't it? Like, you know, and I saw that at those two clubs. And you know yourself, we've all lost in the last kick of the game. And I'm telling you, we all know it. There's nothing as bad as that feeling is, like, you know, and you feel sick and they're all jumping in front of you, they're dug out and celebrating and that, and you feel sick and you want to grab them, you want to punch them, and the feeling won't go away for, you know, it's 3 days of this now. And I experienced that on those two occasions.
Could you tell us about when it kicked off at Blackpool?
It was incredible. do you know what, mate? It was the most frightening thing I've ever seen in my life in football. And I've been around, I've been on the end of some rollickings and, you know, and we were playing Middlesbrough at home. The pitch was terrible. And it was really funny. I had a cranker I worked with later at Forest. He was the manager of Middlesbrough. And we weren't expected to win. They were top, we were bottom, and it was a Tuesday night. The pitch was terrible, like, you know. Anyway, they were winning 1-0. We got a goal back late on, I think. You know, we think we're going to get someone out of the game here, like, you know. And then with a minute to go, as is always the case, ball in, looping header, I think, or I don't know what it was, over Joe, the keeper, like, you know, and in the net and that, like. And that's it again, 93rd minute. They're all going mad next to us. Fair enough, probably overdoing it, but, you know, they were euphoric, and that feeling of the knife and that sickness and that dread. And we got back in the dressing room, and I told this story because you shouldn't really talk about the dressing room, but I felt that because the narrative is that you don't care, you're shit, you don't care about the fans, I thought I would tell this story, like, you know, and it all kicked off. And Jamie O'Hara had been brilliant for us. He'd done everything. He'd play with a bad ankle for games. He'd been our best player. And he started having a go at the goalie about him being sloppy, cost us the game. You know, it's raw. This is effing visceral. This ain't like 3 days later, oh, you couldn't, but this is absolute raw. This is a valuable point gone to nothing, you know. And it kicked off, and he's shouting back. And then Clarkie gets involved, and people were taking sides. And I've never seen it where the whole thing nearly kicked off. It went beyond a scuffle. People were taking sides, and it was horrible. And I was quite scared and that, like, you know. But in the midst of it, like, something really funny happened, like, you know. And Joe Lewis is a great guy. He's doing really well in Scotland now. And he's a mild-mannered guy. But this, his blood was up, and the gloves were off, like, metaphorically. He was a goalkeeper, like, you know. And, like,
you know, should have, like, fucking left the money back.
Yeah, but you know, like, when you're in a hurricane, never been in one, but I've read about them. The winds go through and destroy everything. Then you're in the eye, and then there's that, like, silence, that calm for a minute. But you know the wind's coming again, like, the other side of the thing. And then it went really quiet. And Clarkie was there, like, you know.
At your...
Yeah, at Joe, and Joe was sat there, but Joe's blood was up. Joe's a fantastic guy. And Joe, I'll spell that, I won't swear, like, but Joe Clark, it was like holding himself back, you know, and it was horrific. But the winds had abated. It was in that, like, eye of the storm and that. And Joe goes to Clark, he goes, "You are a effing C-U-N-T. Clark, he just, like, stood there, like, I stood there glaring at him, like, you know, didn't bat an eyelid. And then Joe goes, "You are a piece of S-H-I-T. Yeah. And again, Clarkie, just there. "You are a horrible, I can't remember what it was, horrible piece of crud." You know what I mean? Clarkie didn't bat an eyelid. And then Joe goes, "You are an amateur." He goes, "Amateur." "Amateur." And I burst out laughing. So, yeah, piece of shit. Yeah, all day long. Yeah. Effing C-U-N-T. Yeah, I'm having that, like, you know. Worst human being on the planet. Yeah, why not? Amateur. Then it kicked off again, and they had to be separated. And I'll tell you what, honestly, I tell the story. Lee Clark was brilliant. They were great. Jamie Harder, Joe, they were such good guys. But I'm telling you, I'm telling the fans, that's what it's like. So when you think players don't give a shit, it's not like that. It's not, we want to do well for ourselves, but we want to do well for the fans and the manager and that, like, you know. And that was the worst I've ever seen in 45 years in a dressing room. And there was a couple of minutes where I thought, this is getting out of hand, and people were separated. The whole thing nearly kicked off, and that, like, you know, it stopped, and kind of peace was restored of a kind. And the next day we all came in at a meeting, and Lee Clark was brilliant. He brought it all back with a little bit of self-deprecating humour and some very wise words and that, like, you know. And they did it brilliantly, him and Tomo. They brought everybody back on side, because I drove home that night and I was shaking, honestly. Oh, it was frightening, like, you know. I've never seen anything like that, where it nearly the whole thing imploded and that. But the next day, Clarkie was fantastic. And he asked all the players one by one, what's the problem? A little... Little Perkins, David Perkins, he played with Oliver. He's a great guy. He was at Wigan with me as well, and that, like, you know. And the man said to him, "Perks, come on, you've been around. You're very highly respected in the dressing room and that. What do you think?" And Perks just said, "At the end of the day, we're just not quite good enough." And you know what? That was it. We tried. We prepared. We watched. We trained. We worked on their shape. We watched analysis. You know, we went to bed early, we had pre-match meal, we warmed up properly. At the end of the day, you know, like, I don't think anyone's saying that, you know, the Norwich manager or the they're bad people. No one's saying Sean Dyche is a bad money for sure, but Sean Dyche hasn't quite, with respect, got as strong a team as Pep Guardiola's got. So he's living down there, isn't he? Although he's had amazing success. And that's the reality of the situation. But sometimes I think people don't want to hear that. They're shit, they don't care. Disgrace, a lot of you don't care.
I think that's exactly it. I know you said it's probably the worst thing you've ever seen in football, but Clark, yeah, he's probably gone away that night and thought, half enjoyed that. You know, at least they're giving a bit. Yeah. You know, they're not just sat there.
They care.
Another loss.
They care. And as I say, it was kind of the perfect storm. And it had been brewing, it had been coming, and the defeat and that sick feeling. And just the way it came, I talk about the waves out to sea. Every now and again, just seeing some events that form as a 100-foot wave and that, like, you know. And that night on that pitch in the dark, and it was an element of them over-celebrating. It was an element of the, we didn't expect anything out of the game. They're top of the league. We nearly got a point. It was an element of the weather was terrible all week in training. And it was just everything came together that night and produced that. But as I say, nobody's fault, no one to blame. People who cared too much in a way. Because if you don't care, you don't have that, do you?
You can take that, can't you?
Absolutely.
The analogy
is
as long as everybody cares, we just weren't quite good enough.
Yeah. As I say, you know, you don't get that if people don't care.
Mm. Did you have John Joe Kenny in them youth teams?
Yeah, I've got great memories of John Joe. And of course, when I went back to Everton, I've seen him a lot. He was, everything to be admired in a young player. In fact, funnily enough, before we won the Euros in Malta, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, we had an England training camp. We played Belgium at St George's Park in probably the March, and he was playing right back, right in front of the dugout. He went up for a ball, landed awkwardly, crack, and I ran on 2 yards from him. He's lying on his back, like, you know, and obviously he's broken his collarbone, like, and he looked up at me and he gritted his teeth and he goes, "Baz, lad, you's better get me fit for that fine than summer, lad." And I said to him, "You'll score the winning goal." And do you know what? He scored the winning goal from the penalty spot.
Yeah.
And that team that won the Euros had some really good players in, like, Joe Gomez captained it. And we had, like, Adam Armstrong and Solanke and Josh Onema and Patrick Roberts and Lewis Cook. And forgive me if I've missed some players out. And that we had a terrific, they called it like a 10-year high, a 10-year good team. Like, and they won the World Cup, I think, a year or two later, like, you know. And we won it on penalties over there. And as I said before, that was the most amazing experience because you're doing it for your country, like, you know. And back at the
home. Being part of that.
Yeah. Oh, it was amazing.
Fill you with pride.
Oh, it was amazing. Like, and, you know, the final whistle goes, and obviously on loop, it's "We are the champions, we are the champions." And back to the hotel, champagne for the staff.
I was about to ask that. What does you know, if you're in the under-17s, how do the lads celebrate? Like, just
milk.
Fuck it, we'll stop up till 4 on PlayStation.
No, there's what's it called? That drink that's like, that they drink it in Malta. It's like a Coca-Cola flat stuff. With them, it was them for the lads anyway, but champagne, it was amazing, you know what, really emotional. And when we got off the bus and went in, it was a big hotel, and called the Seacrest in Melilla Bay, and there were mainly British holidaymakers in there. And when we walked in there after the game, everybody stood and started clapping, and I'll tell you, it brings the tears to your eyes and that, like, you know. One of the best memories of that trip, it's really funny because only 8 get to the final, 7 plus the host, and I felt our name was on that. And when I looked at the groups, obviously Malta are one of the 8. I looked at the groups and we were drawn in the 4 with Malta. Match day 1, Malta. Now, you should beat Malta. So you're going into your second game against Turkey, commanding the group. Germany were favourites in that. And as I say, like, you know, Germany always have an extra boss, more staff, nice tracksuits, just loads of stuff. And, like, and there is something about Germans who, it's an amazing country. We've all been there. Amazing footballers, sports people, but there is a little bit of something that rubs us up the wrong way, isn't there? I don't know what it is, you know, but they got knocked out by Scotland. It was unbelievable. Scotty Gemmell, managing Scotland, ex-Everton, like, you know, and they knocked him out. And I'll never forget this. The next morning, they left, obviously, you know, 8 teams become 4 in the hotel, 4 teams become 2 in the hotel as the tournament commences. And the day that Germany left in their 2 team buses with all their gear.
Oh, so you all stop in the same hotel?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you stay in the same hotel. Right. Yeah. So it's all a bit odd, awkward, almost, like, you know. But that day I was out on my mobile phone and the Germans left. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, it was like an English stroke British typical, you know, holiday hotel, like, you know. And as a German coach pulled away, there were dozens and dozens of Brits, all sunburned backs and Union Jack shorts, out in the road giving them the V's. Brownie.
Fuck off.
Brownie, grown-ups, toddlers, grandparents,
all 17,
all fantastically involved in the giving it that. Oh my God, I'm telling you, that is one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life, mate. Unbelievable, mate.
God. Oh, dear.
Just jumping back a little bit, just back to Man United, because obviously you entering the club that is Man United, during that massive transit, because yeah. Sir Alex would have been there in
absolutely,
year,
yeah,
and
yeah.
You were there for that period, yeah. The old transition,
yeah.
And everything could. Yeah. I mean, for David Moyes, I imagine. Did you think it were like a poison chalice at the time? Following,
looking back, yeah, but it's really interesting. Like all through my life, it always seems to be everywhere I am, things are happening and that. So I went into Man United for Ferguson's last 5 months, and then Dave came in. And then obviously Van Gaal came in the year later, like, you know. So I experienced in those, I was only there 2 years, all that change and that. And it was really interesting because we've seen it all with AC Milan and we've seen it with Barcelona now. These unbeatable dynasties, it does end eventually. And whoever came in after Ferguson, I don't even want to say David failed. You know, it was a period of transition, so I'm not saying he failed, would have found it difficult. Whoever would have came in, like, you know, and I believe if Dave would have been another year, things would have been okay and he would have turned it round. But I say it was almost that it had to be that way. There had to be that kind of period of grieving after, what, nearly 30 years of Ferguson and that, like, you know. And as I say, I saw Dave and he did everything the same and picked similar players and stuff and nothing really happened different. It was just that dynasty was in, like the Romans and all the great dynasties, it went into decline and it's very hard to turn. They're still finding it hard now, aren't they? Like, you know, They had their glory 20 years, didn't they? And now it's maybe somebody else's. Now they'll get back there eventually, won't they? But it's not going to be easy. It takes time to turn it round.
How impressive was he, Sir Alex?
Oh, unbelievable. You know, on that first day when I'd nutmegged Jesse across, McCade across the box, won the run, on the way in, I'm going in, and Sir Alex is holding the door and he goes, come in, he holds the door for me, like, you know, and he's with Tony Strudwick, who's a good friend of mine, who's an amazing fitness coach. He goes, Mick, I was just telling Strudders about how you slaughter fitness coach in your first book, which I don't. I don't, but I thought to myself, oh my God, he's taken the trouble to flick through that book. And I was saying the book, he's the most amazing guy I've ever met. And you know that, oh, he knows everybody. I thought, oh, yeah, well, he don't. But he did. He knew everybody's name. Everybody who was at Carrington, he knew their names. And I just assumed he'd be a miserable bugger who shouted at everybody. He weren't. He could not have been anything other than what I perceived him to be. He was always charming, smiling. He could hold court or he could sit back and listen. He had an incredible knowledge of... He was telling me one day about the coffee machine and that. Amazing guy. I was getting a cup of coffee. He goes, yeah, hey, it costs a lot of money. You know why? But, you know, and when you think back, when you think back, it had to be that way. You couldn't rule by fear and be a miserable bug and have that success. You had to have that sophistication and highly intelligent guy and so personable, so likable, so utterly charming and that, like, you know. And it was really funny because when I went to Wigan with Warren and I was worried about my age and that, like, you know, Warren goes, oh, Sir Alex is coming in today, like, you know. And I thought, oh, I hope he remembers me, like, you know. And I went in, Sir Alex was there, and he goes, hi, how you doing, Mick? I said, all right. He goes, I can't believe you're still working at your bloody age. Well, I thought, well, at least you remember me. Like, you know? So we'll call that a draw.
How did you find Van Gaal?
Aloof, distant. Yeah. Aloof's probably a bad word. He's not going to want to take me for coffee, is he, like the under-21s mentor, you know, but it was okay. Staff were very nice. They were really nice, you know. But he brought in, I was MR, and he brought in a guy called Marcus Rakers, I think. I think he's the guy at Arsenal now. So when I got back to pre-season after the Euros and that, and when I've been away and we won that trophy, I felt really important because I had a defined role. And then going back there, slipping into that ill-defined role, I felt quite low about it. And then when I got my top, I was M.R. And then I thought, oh, God. And then they were bringing another physio in for the first one called Matt Ratcliffe.
Oh, no.
I thought, I'm going to be M.R.
M.R. M.R.
It's
like a fucking Google thing, isn't it? Put his email address on here.
Yeah, I know. So... But then Van Gaal said, look, you know, and it was more aimed at a couple of the senior staff who worked with the first team. And Van Gaal kind of said, look, if you either work for Man U or England and that, like, so we had a kind of ultimatum. And I wanted to stay with the physio. I wanted to stay with England and that. So it allowed me a quite easy out. And I left and and that was it. And I drove out after 2 years, and I drove through the barrier, the exit, and that. And the guy said, "Yeah, see you later," and went back to his crossword. And that was probably a metaphor for my time there. Like, you know,
Baz, how on earth did you end up in Montserrat?
Well, Danny Donaghy phoned me up, like, you know, and he said, "Baz," he goes, "my dad's got a job somewhere in the Caribbean." He goes, "He's going to need some help," like, you know. So
I think you were just about getting it before we did the last one, were it?
Yeah.
You were just kicking off.
Yeah.
Well, I met Willie, and we've become very close friends in that, like, you know, and he told me it was Montserrat. And I knew all about Montserrat, about the volcano and stuff, like, you know. And I said I could do the four trips. There's four international breaks, and I would do the four trips with him. And I went. It was the most amazing experience. He's the most amazing guy. He taught me a lot about myself and about life. And for me, without going over the top, it was that second trip where we beat Belize 1-0, and the day after, and the walk to the volcano, that was my road to Damascus. And I spent a lot of time just listening and talking, or comfortable silences, and walking all around the island. They're really hilly. We walked miles together and that, like, you know. And one day he just said to me, "Stop, stand still, listen." And I thought, wow, wasn't that the 3 degrees from the 70s? And he goes, "What can you hear?" I said, "Nothing." He goes, "Well, listen harder. Listen harder. What? Listen harder." So I listened. All of a sudden, I can hear the waves and the sea, and there's a dog barking, and he's at a shutter blowing too, and you can actually hear the rust of the leaves and that. So I told him that. He goes, "Yeah, good. Listen harder." So I listened harder. And then you become aware of your breath and your own heartbeat and that. And I say in the book, Jesus, that was some weird S-H-I-T, like, you know. And then we just walked off and that, like, you know. And that time I spent with him changed me a lot, if you can change in four trips and that. You know, and the people on the island, it's all so laid back. So the guy used to bring the minibus for the players. We walked everywhere. The guy bought the minibus, like, you know, he was late. I said, you're late. He goes, "Oh, man," he goes, "You early," and he smiled and that. Yeah. Well, the game just kicked off, by the way. So if that's early, all the best, mate. So, but then after a while, you get seduced by it. So we've trained in the morning, like, and the ladies are making the food. It's amazing. "Food, 5 minutes late, 5 minutes late." He goes, the food will come, you know. Just sit on the grass, enjoy the sunshine. We bring the." And after a while, you get seduced by it, and you realise that it's us rushing round and that, you know.
The rat race.
And he wasn't late. We said, "Be here at 9 o'clock. He came at 10 past, big deal. We train at 10, or train at 10 past, train at 11. It's like paradise, like, you know. So you do become kind of seduced by that lifestyle and the calmness of life and stuff, like, you know. And the guys who went over there, British subjects from Montserration, parents or grandparents, mainly playing like National League South, mainly one pro. I've got more now, like, you know. And they were so proud to play for nothing. And I saw that altruism that I'd forgot existed, because I've been in the Premier League, where it's all about the money, obviously, you know, that's how it is there, like, you know. But this was different. These guys were working and driving trains and working in shops and that, and still giving up. They got reimbursed their wage, but they're not getting paid for playing and that, like, you know. And they all turned up, and they had their passports, didn't have to chase them around and that, because these were men who had jobs, and that they could get on the plane without me picking them up and putting them on and that, like, you know.
what were the, just to give some context to the challenge that was afoot, like, what's the population? 5, 6, 7,000?
5,000. There were more on, but the volcano destroyed half the island and that. So
what are the expectations put on you to take over this national team?
Well, they were bottom ranked at the time. They hadn't won for 3 years and that, like, you know. And I kept saying to Willie, I think we'll win all games. I thought, oh, God. So I'm trying to, so, like,
what kind of level are you playing? Some of the other islands, or
so the first game was against El Salvador, 6 million people, soccer mad. So the lads and Willie are talking about clean sweep, 4 wins. So I'm trying to give Willie some, like, I say, Willie, like, you know, can we get real about this? Like, you know, if we couldn't get beat by fewer than 10 in the first game, and then Belize, 2 million people, soccer mad. If we can hold them to 6 in the second game. The game's supposed to get easier in the groupings. Third game, Curaçao, big island, some good Dutch-type players, because it's a kind of Dutch colony. If we can, like, maybe could maybe get a draw there. And then Grant came and we might edge a win. Oh, no, I think we're in all the games. Like, you know. So I'm thinking, why, this guy's deluded, like, you know. But you know what? The lads, it was incredible. The lads were fantastic. So we got, it's so hard to get there. It's me and Willie drive to Heathrow through the night. Then it's like 11 hours to Miami. Then it's Miami to Antigua. Then it's a catamaran chopping across the waters. Like, you know, it's unbelievable. We get on the plane, I'm sat with the players, like, you know, and the drinks Charlie comes rattling down, like, you know, I'm thinking, oh, no. If this was a Premier League team or Everton, if that trolley would have come within 100 yards of a player, that person would have been, oh, don't you dare. If that would have been Dave or any of the managers, how dare you? They're not having, you know, would have been like 14 orange juices anyway. So the lady comes up with the trolley and she goes, would you like a drink for the flight, sir? I said, yeah, I'll have a Coke. So I got a Coke. She asked the lad next to me, would you like a drink? He goes, yeah, I'll have two beers and a double Jack Daniels and Coke. The next lad piled into the vodka. He's had the whiskey as well. He's got three bottles of wine under his bloody seat. And the lad turns to me and goes, don't you drink, Baz? I thought, right, I'm getting pissed on the way back. But, you know, the whole point of it, the whole point of that story was they had their couple of drinks, slept on the flight. They didn't get pissed. They didn't abuse. They didn't fall off the plane at the far end. The men, they behave like men. They're here to win. They're here to do a job. And while we were there, the whole thing was about the experience and enjoying, because I thought we're going to lose all the games. But it was, we wanted it to be a magical experience in magical places. And it turned out to be that. And that second game, we lost the first game in the 95th minute, 2-1 against El Salvador.
The one that you're taking 10?
Yeah, yeah. We were winning. They got two late goals. We were out on our feet because the lads have been driving trains and working in shops the day before. And we had like a 2-day trip to get there. Like, you know, the second game a month later, we beat Belize. And there was like, I don't know, 1,000 people at the game and the drums. You can imagine the perfect night and that, you know. And me and Willie sloped away. Like, you know, there was a little shack, like, you know, and obviously Willie's a Buddhist, like, you know, and there was a little lady there, open all night, and she gave us the beers and we sat there, and there was a goat and a chicken, and the goat was like sat on Willie's head, like, and I say in the book, he probably knew from a previous life, like, you know, like, you know. And we sat there in that perfect night, in that perfect quiet, and a mile away, the lads still in their kit and out on the pitch and that, like, drinking and celebrating, all the fans and the drums and that, like, you know, and the barbecue. And my God, those lads deserve that, because most of them lads had started at big clubs and slipped down. But, you know, OK, technically slipped down and that, but not through lack of desire, just maybe not quite good enough on that. But they'd all hung on in there and they'd stayed and they'd played, and every dog has his day. And that day on the pitch with the drums and the barbecue and the beers and shoulder high, they were carried by the fans. That was their day. So they deserve that.
So do you know to pick your Montserrat squad, is it basically just anybody who plays football in England?
Yes, it was. Yes. It's been fine-tuned now. Willie's taken it on for 2 years now. And actually, a couple of lads from Salford can play for it. And Willie's done great. He's unearthed a lot of players who are third-generation Montserratians. And the team now is actually probably all professional. Kyle Taylor.
Yeah.
He came on three ships. He was amazing because he was a pro at Charlton. And it is a lot of travelling, a lot of stuff and that, like, you know, to play in front of, like, 1,000 people, 1,500 people on AstroTurf a lot of the games and that, like. So but was that
your job to kind of persuade these lads, sell them
yeah,
what?
Yeah, Willie's job, yeah. And obviously, as we got the fame and that, and we won the games and got more press and publicity and the goals on loop in the CONCACAF, and I didn't realise there's 42 countries in CONCACAF. I thought it was Mexico and Jamaica and three others, but it's not. There's 41 countries. It's really thriving when you get over there, and it does mean the world. And all the Antigua's got a good team, Aruba, Bonaire, Cuba, they've all got teams and that who play, and then it means a lot to those teams. When we're over here, we don't really get it, we don't really realise, but when you're over there, it is a big deal, CONCACAF.
There's a movie in that, isn't there?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
The mad Buddhist coach.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, yeah. You make a bobsleigh team,
isn't he? Yeah. The goat from real life.
It was an amazing experience. And again, we didn't, you know, say to the players, you must be in your bed, you must not drink. We just said, look, lads, do what you want to do. But they were hard on each other. They policed each other ruthlessly. And half-time in every game, they were effing and blinding at each other. Me and Willie could go in and that, like, you know, because they wouldn't accept second best. And you know, like, the modern players will kind of sit there quietly, please, let's get changed and go home. These lads were vicious and voracious, and they they policed each other and they monitored each other. And on the day of the first game, I said, right, lads, it's warm. Get back to your hotels, air conditioning on. They didn't go back. You know, pros are like the comatose. We fear lying in the bed, if we lose tonight. And these lads didn't have those fears. So they went out swimming, and me and Willie went for a walk, and a couple of them having a coffee and walking. If I'd seen a few lads with a beer, no big deal, not a problem. Because the other lads wouldn't then get away with that anyway. So it was a really incredible experience in terms of seeing that other side of football. People just determined to... I'm not saying pros aren't determined to play, but of course they are. But when you take the money out of it, you take a lot of the pressure away and you bring in the experience of playing for the shirt and that. And it taught me a lot about football because I come conditioned to believe that, yeah, you get paid that much and that it's all about money. And if you get moved to a better club, you get for more money. And that is essentially how it is in professional sport. That's just the way it is. But these guys weren't like that. These guys, and we had an incredible situation whereby Willie had let us, them all kind of help picking the team. And he picked the team one day and they went, look, you know, we think he should play and instead of him. And him who would have been out went, yeah, you're right, he should be in front of me. Like, you know,
I've only come for a fucking holiday.
I wanted to say that in the 70s, you know, when I was a player, you know what, I actually leave me out, so I'll put him in. But you can't when you're a pro, can you? And we saw that and it was incredible. And everybody was determined not to be the weakest link. And it was just amazing. The whole thing, like, put the whole, I don't know, thing into perspective.
Yeah, because I suppose from a fan's perspective, people get disillusioned with the money around the game. And
yeah,
but
yeah.
I suppose these lads are playing just for the opportunity to play. Because they've no chance of playing international football.
No.
So the opportunity to just play international football
Absolutely.
And be part of it and experience it. Yeah. That's the reason that they're
Absolutely.
There.
Plus, it's a fucking, I'm sure it's a very nice country as well.
Yeah,
so
I'm sure it's bloody lovely.
It's an amazing country.
How is it funded? Because I'm sure...
I'm assuming CONCACAF or more likely FIFA must fund it. Because, you know, notwithstanding the fact the lads don't get paid, they were reimbursed for lost wages. And we only took 14 players, only me and Willie's staff. So, but that's 16 transatlantic flights. That's 16 times 5 nights in the hotel in Montserrat. So it's still tens of thousands of pounds, you know. So,
are you getting paid the same?
Well, it was really interesting because Willie said to me, it's £1,000. Now, I didn't know if that was £1,000 pineapples, but I would, yeah. But I weren't bothered because I was there for experience and that, like, you know. Yeah. Having said that, I got over there and I found that the local currency is East Caribbean dollars. £1,000 of them is about £80, you know. But and I'd already bought seasickness tablets, £40, like, you know. So I was already down on it, like. But I found out it was just US dollars. So actually, $1,000 was like £900. And it paid for the expenses, but it was not about the money, unlike Smell of Football 2, obviously. Which I've sort of changed my mind now. It's wholly about the money. So
it took an hour and 40 minutes.
I did get there, yeah. But it was an incredible experience, and it changed. I don't want to say it changed my life, but it made me see things very, very differently than what I previously had when you're heads down in the professional game.
So and as well as that, is it? Yeah, everyday life, like you worry about getting old, you worry about pressures of work. Did that?
That went. As I say, that went. And I say, I went back into Everton. And I always had this thing about getting to 60. And I got back and a phone call, come back to Everton. I'll start tomorrow. It's my 60th birthday today. I'm back. Absolutely incredible. And I went back in and somebody said, how are you, Ben? I said, I'm 60. You don't look 60. It was like magical, the whole thing. And it seemed the whole journey through the book, I kept saying, this is more than just coincidence. This is part of something. And when I got to the end, I thought, wow, this has kind of joined up the loop and that. So it turned out to be amazing, really, the whole thing.
Well, I know you've read the new book, and I've read it. It's due back tomorrow.
And I'll be reading that exact same book very shortly.
Thank you.
Encourage anyone to
I'll be honest with you, but if I get back in time, it could actually be a Christmas present for my dad as well.
that's absolutely fantastic. Absolutely. Thank you.
Who changed your mind on sports science?
The guys at Nottingham Forest, they were brilliant, and I saw it done well. I saw it done with a soft touch. I saw it done with a less is more approach, seeing that each player's individual and they're not all the same and that, like, you know. So I saw it done really, really well. And I saw the guy at Rochdale take my lad, work him, get him fitter and quicker and stronger and transform him into quite a smallish late developer into a really quick, strong player. So I saw it done on a couple of levels. Fantastic one. I thought, yeah, I'm having this now, like, you know, so.
Good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for coming on.
Well, I've really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed it, you know.
really appreciate it. And, we'll have the link in the description.
Well, thank you very much, guys.
If anybody wants to get the book,
well,
jump straight on it.
Yeah, well, that's fine. And
get some more envelopes.
Yeah. But I can't wait to.
Better looks, and we might buy you a brick stick for Christmas.
Yeah. Poor wife with her chapped lips. Great stuff. Thank you for inviting me on.
Cheers.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.